And I think one of the remarkable things about this story and the movie and Aaron is that there's a lot of surprising turns, some of which are really positive, some of which are negative. But there's always this interplay between your small contribution, your big contribution, your individuality, and this larger movement that you're nourishing. And for me, what was so amazing about the movie was that it honored Aaron. It highlighted the extreme tragedy of the situation. But at least for me, it hit on a very hopeful note, which I think is what Aaron was always trying to push for. And there are these moments where you think things are so impossible. The surveillance is so extensive. The economic injustices are so grave. And yet if people don't continue to enter into that arena, they will swallow everyone. And so again, I think the movie just so brilliantly weaves between the personal and the social, and between the sort of tragedy and huge problems that we face, but really there's a possibility for everyone to kind of jump in there and you know, make the change that we all want to see.
I was in D.C. the week before some of the debates. Everyone I met in D.C., all my Hill reference, said just go home, give up. You can't win the count of the votes. Every one of these congressmen and senators, their full-time job is fundraising for re-election. Their part-time job is being lawmakers. And the people who they depend on to continue to have a job in the next sitting of Congress, they've given them the marching orders, and you can't win this one. Start thinking about what to do and about a world in which this is reality, not a world. Don't try to think about how to make it a world in which this is reality. And the Demand Progress people, and the Fight for the Future kids, and Aaron, and EFF, the stuff that they built, the stuff that let people directly call the congressmen and senators, put 8 million phone calls through to Congress in the space of a few days. And Congress worked out that as hard as it is to get reelected without money, it's much harder to get reelected without votes. And that was a remarkable existence proof, because I don't know if you saw, there was a scholarly research released last week where they examined 20,000 policy outcomes for the last 20 years in American politics and discovered that almost without exception, the policy outcome that arose from any lawmaking procedure was the one that benefited the corporate entity with the deepest pockets. And, you know, this was not written by, you know, Starbucks smashing anti-globalists. This was written by a couple of sober-sided traditional economists and political scientists who concluded this. And the fact that SOPA went the other way and so dramatically is really a proof, first of all, of what's at stake, and second of all, of what's possible. And that's something I think there are his colleague showed us.
You know, after this kind of relentless pursuit of the truth, to some degree, I mean, obviously hacking is a broad term that encompasses lots of different subcategories of activity, but, you know, they seem to be, after some like, sort of objective truth, as if that's possible, but the, you know, they rattle around these kinds of walls of deception, and I think that we need the truth, right? Whether that's the truth of the universe in terms of science, technology, you know, knowledge and research, the kinds of things that Aaron was after, or that's the truth of our actual relationship with our government, as opposed to the relationship we think we have with our government. That big piece of that puzzle was just missing before, you know, Edward Snowden came forward. In any case, we're dealing with big, intractable problems, the human race is, and the only way we solve those problems is to come on with the truth, you know, unsullied by political power and by corporate greed. It's the only way we make lives better for people around the world, solve problems like climate change, figure out how to govern ourselves. And so here's the big, academics are a big part of this. And so having this, not having access to this is becomes a very critical kind of.
Well, as an academic who writes articles that are put up on places like JSTOR, there was apparently a study that showed the average number of reads that each academic article gets is 2, which is quite low. And secretly, all academics want their stuff read. And if you talk to most anyone about this case, they will tell you that it's completely perverted that the justice system went after Aaron for downloading these articles. And what is also really remarkable is that, you know, by the time he did this, and again, we really don't know what he was planning to do with them, there really had been a robust change where academics, librarians, activists, writers had pivoted away from copyright to engage in questions of open access. And so I think that was what was so shocking about this case. When I heard about the fact that he was being prosecuted for journal articles, for downloading a large show of them, I also was skeptical that this could go anywhere. I thought it would fizzle. What it really showed is that, you know, the justice system is vengeful. And also I think that in particular, the prosecution Department of Justice really did grow concerned over whistleblowers and hackers in the last number of years, because in the past, they might transgress for the pleasure of breaking into systems. It's fun to break rules, but there had been a true kind of turn towards the political. And if there's one individual who really really glowed in that department, it was Aaron Swartz. And I do think that they were scared of him in a kind of larger sense.